Welcome to Brain VR Podcast. Today we are going to be speaking with John Werecki. John Werecki, welcome to our show.
Thank you. Thank you. Glad to be here.
Thanks for being here and making time for us. I wanted to ask you if you could introduce yourself to our audience and introduce your work as well.
Sure. Thank you, Vojta. So I'm an associate professor in the teaching stream at the University of Toronto in Canada. So I'm cross-appointed. I'm in psychology, where I do basically cognitive psychology, and then I'm also in the cognitive science program, where I'm the director of the cognitive science program. And so I do a lot of work studying the nature of cognition, so topics like intelligence and rationality and wisdom and consciousness and altered states of consciousness are sort of central to what my sort of scientific work is. But all of those topics give us, I think, especially some of the cutting edge stuff that's happening right now, give us some valuable information about how human beings make sense of and experience meaning in their lives, and how valuable and important that meaning is to their healthy agency. And so because of that, I also do work trying to connect the scientific material to its existential import for people's lives. So I do work addressing what I call the meaning crisis, and we can talk more about that, of course, and not just at a theoretical level, but trying to use that cognitive science and the best history we can engage in to help engineer practices of transformation that will help improve people's ability to make sense, overcome self-deception, and enhance meaning in life. So that's sort of me in a nutshell. Wow, that might be the most concise I've done in a while.
Nice. Thank you for that. So for us, it's really interesting that you're not only talking about these things and teaching these things. You have this incredible series of lectures on YouTube, Awakening from the Meaning Crisis, 50-hour-long lectures, they've been incredible for us, incredible source of inspiration and actual insight and wisdom. And for us, the most, I think, interesting part of that is that you are also living all of these things. I think you have to live them to be able to come up with so many insights and such a body of work behind you. How did you came to this point? How did you come up, and what was your background getting interested, and main pillars of, like, what was the point where you decided to actually study cognitive sciences and study meaning and wisdom?
Oh, well, that's a bit of a long story. So I was actually brought up as a kid in a very harsh form of fundamentalist Christianity. Now, the thing about that is it's like your mother tongue, or it's like you're the first place you live in your life. Even if you leave it and never return, it leaves a lasting impression on you. And it leaves you with a taste for something. And so one of the things I argue, and I think I can argue this with good evidence and reason, is that one of the things religions try to do is enhance people's experience of meaning in life. And so that taste really was left in me. But in my mid-teens, when people often start to explore leaving home, I was exposed to some literature that opened me right up, just sort of blew me out of that world and made me realize there was so much more. Now, that, of course, was positive, but it also had a huge negative consequence for me, which is, like many teenagers, but exacerbated by that, I experienced my own sort of very personal, first round, my own personal meaning crisis. And so ideas about nihilism became very prominent for me. But then I got into university, and because this was this literature, I was getting an interest in philosophy. So I took an introduction to philosophy course, and I met in Plato the figure of Socrates, which just had this really, really profound impact on me. And the idea that what could help people find ways of making sense and realizing authentic meaning could be realized through the cultivation of wisdom. Philosophia, in the ancient sense, as the joint love of wisdom. So I took that up, and I took up philosophy. But after that class, that one course, the topic of wisdom drops off the table in academic philosophy. Now that's starting to change now, but long time ago in a galaxy far, far away, when I was in as an undergraduate. That wasn't the case. Now, I had already gotten to see and appreciate quite deeply the value of academic philosophy for conceptual clarity and meta-science and meta-cultural critique, but this hunger for the cultivation of wisdom didn't abate in me. It just increased. So I happened to live near a place that I had seen called the Tai Chi and Meditation Center, where they taught, you know, Vipassana meditation, meta-contemplation, and Tai Chi Chuan as an integrated ecology of practices, and I decided I would look there for wisdom. And so I started taking that up, and then I started to become aware of aspects of knowing outside of propositional knowing, the procedural. I often talk about the procedural and the perspectival and the participatory, and this ecology of practices just woke that up in me in a way that is like when you fall in love with somebody profoundly. And just so it was deeply woken up in me. And I was also starting to see that there are, and you guys alluded to this a few minutes ago, there are many truths that are only realizable in transformation. You can't just think them. You have to go through the transformation that makes it capable for you to realize them. And so these two ideas started to become very prominent in my mind, right? These kinds of knowing outside of propositional theoretical knowing, and the kind of enhanced contact with reality that comes through transformation. And so I was continuing on in these practices, and I had become disillusioned with academic philosophy. I had my MA, and I dropped out for a year, and I was doing all this other stuff. And then I heard about this new emerging discipline, just starting to get going full steam in the 80s, cognitive science. And so I went back to university, and I got a specialist, you know, honors, the BSc in cognitive science. And then I started to see, oh, this is a way about talking about the mind scientifically, that it started to give me a way of, you know, thinking about these transformations and experiences and practices. And then that confluence, and then the cognitive science was also evolving. And, right, the procedural and the perspectival and the participatory were becoming more and more important. And they were, and psychology was starting to talk about wisdom. And then, right, and then all of a sudden, bang, these came together for me. And I started to see just deep and profound resonance between the practice and the emerging content of cognitive science and the practice of the cultivation of wisdom and the overcoming of self-deception and the affording of enhanced connectedness to oneself and to other people in the world. And so I started to teach this. And it was very successful for me. Students really became attracted to that, even if it was only implicit, that confluence. I was one of the first people to, for example, academically teach about mindfulness at the University of Toronto, right? And so that kept growing. And then my friend of mine, a colleague, and he was a colleague of mine at U of T, and somebody who's had just a profound influence on my thinking, which is Evan Thompson. Because he is, for me, the epitome of fourth generation cognitive or third generation cognitive science, what's called 4E cognitive science. But he was supposed to teach a course called Buddhism and Cognitive Science, and he couldn't teach it, and so he recommended me, and I taught it. And instead of doing a survey or blah 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 blah, I thought what I'll do is I'll try and argue for something that was already forming in my mind. And what was forming in my mind is this confluence I was finding between cognitive science and the cultivation of wisdom was attractive to many people other than myself. That's what I was seeing. That's what I was getting at least good anecdotal evidence for. And so I thought, well, why don't I, you know, like a scientist, well, actually put it on the block, do it, you know, see if you're right. And so I built this course on the idea that human being, where we have an increasing hunger for bringing science and spirituality together. And that's why there's this increasing confluence between Buddhism and cognitive science and other things, so Stoicism now and other things. And so that course turned into an argument about how to try and address this hunger for meaning by bringing together cognitive science and spiritual practices. And it just took off. And so what kept happening is students would keep coming to me and say, and the thing is, I have many of my other courses feed into that course, right? It's sort of the summative course. And many students were coming to me and saying, you've got to get this out. So I had a staff, one of my students came to me and he said, you know, I've got professional training and my dad's a professional editor. Let's turn this into a series. And that's how Awakening from the Meaning Crisis came. I took that course on Buddhism and cognitive science, the course I teach on the psychology of wisdom, courses I teach on cognitive development, on thinking and reasoning, and I just put it all together. So that's how I got here.
Well, yeah, that's really amazing the way how we can relate to that actually with Christoph, because we are just studying neuroscience. We are just neuroscience students. And right. At the start, when we started going to the university, consciousness was our biggest interest, right? And
right.
It wasn't fulfilling us. The university itself and the teachings there weren't fulfilling us. We needed yeah. to think about it, to talk about it. And what you were describing is this kind of reciprocal opening to the world, right? You put yep. out the yep. things and the things came back and they blew up. So the world reacted to you putting stuff yeah. out. And similarly, we 2 years ago, we were having these deep conversations, which we found like super meaningful for us. It was changing our lives. And we just said to ourselves, we had some values to actually put out the work, because if it, put out the stuff that we are talking about. So we created this podcast actually, and it's hard at first to just, you have a fear about it, right? You are
yeah,
you fear how the world is gonna react to it. But we said, yeah. okay, we just wanna do 10 episodes. We just wanna affect positively one person. And we just want to love it. We want to love what we are doing. And those was our only things. And they got fulfilled really fast. And after that, we are like 86 episodes in, like 100 of hours of our brains recorded somewhere on the internet. And also for Czech Republic, it blew us as well. It blew up as well. So this is really reminding me that it's kind of a similar, but also you are a professor basically, and you are teaching this right on the university and you're just like students. But amazing thing is that anyone can take their brain and their thoughts and mind and put them on the internet and have this reciprocal opening in the world
yep.
and have
yep.
feedback that can lead to some things which we cannot we can't know what's gonna come after it, right? So now we are actually talking to you, and this is really interesting moment for us, because we were listening to you for over a year, and it's been amazing, and it's such a pleasure to talk to you now.
Yeah, it is.
That's a great story.
Yeah, for our lives, and it's interesting that we started with interest in brain. And when you are interested in brain and you want to know how the brain works, you realize that you need to go out to the world, to the environment yeah. around you, and study the basic principles around you. And yeah. that's how we got into the studying of meaning and studying of right. meaning crisis. And that's where your lectures really helped us. And that's the thing I would like to ask you about.
Give our
listeners some introduction to meaning and what is meaning crisis and why are we in one.
Okay, so that's cool. I just wanted to note before I answer Christoph's question that it doesn't surprise me that you found a way to too reciprocally open to the world out of deep, what I call deep dialogos, those kinds of conversations that take a life, take on a life of their own and open you up in profound ways. So I think it's no coincidence that that was the genesis for ways in which you guys are now on this course of reciprocal opening. And that's something that I'm actually really trying to study very deeply right now, that relation, that exact relationship. So thank you for saying that, because it's just sort of just another instance, another case of something that's really fascinating me right now, that relationship between, you know, these conversations and then that sense of opening up the world. I think that's really, really crucial. So thank you for relating your story. It's encouraging to me. Meaning. So when I talk about when we talk about meaning, we have to be careful. Here's the philosopher in me coming out, because we're ultimately using a metaphor. It's a good metaphor. It's not a bad metaphor, but it's a good metaphor. Because the things that literally have meaning are like sentences, statements. That's what we typically call semantic meaning. And then the idea of the metaphor is, well, what goes on in a sentence? Well, somehow, and we try to study this in syntax and semantics, right? The pieces fit together in a way that fits my cognition and allows me to understand you, make sense of the world. And like I said, linguistics tries to study that, syntax, semantics, pragmatics. So all of those, all that rich dimensionality is in there. And then the idea is this. Maybe there's something deeply analogous to how my experience unfolds, my phenomenological and conceptual experience, how it unfolds, that's analogous to that. Maybe there's a way in which, right, everything that's happening in my experience fits together, and of course we're creeping around the topic of consciousness here, how everything fits together, right, and then makes sense to me so I can make sense to the world, right? And so what we're looking for is the ways in which, as cognitive agents, as beings who are doing, have a sensory motor interaction with the world and are engaged in comprehensive and ongoing problem solving, how do we fit information together so it fits my cognition, and I always mean my embodied cognition, right? So that I better and better fit the world as a sensory motor problem solver. And so at the key of my work is a process I call relevance realization, which is the issue about, out of all of the available information, all the possible courses of interaction, all the information in my long-term memory, I can zero in like that on the relevant information. And that is, I've argued and I continue to argue and amass more evidence and argument. I think that's the core of what it is to be intelligent. But here's the idea that comes out of that, which I think is one of the big ideas that has come out of cognitive psychology, which is those very processes that are indispensable to my being an adaptive, active sensory motor problem solver also continually create bias in me. Because if I'm finding some information relevant, that means I'm treating a lot of other information as irrelevant. And we often do that well, but the price we pay for that is that we are perennially at risk of getting it wrong. We focus and fixate on the wrong information as salient, but it actually isn't the information that's needed for us to solve our problems. And for me, that is the primordial basis of our pervasive capacity for self-deception. So we're trying to make sense. We're trying to get, and how I kept emphasizing, this is sensory motor problem solving. This is how the information fits together, fits me, and fits me to the world. Deep connectedness. I'm connected to myself. I'm connected to you guys. I'm connected to my environment. But that adaptive process is also perpetually putting itself at risk, because the self-deception, right, can make me actually disconnected from myself. So I get self-destructive behavior. Most of the time when we're self-deceived, we fall into self-destructive behavior. The ways in which we're self-deceived undermines our relationships to other people. It causes us to lose touch with reality. And you can see, it's a wonderful and horrible experiment, how social media just It puts all those processes on speed and magnifies them and amplifies. You can see how people could just spin off now and just, right? And so what we have needed is we've needed very comprehensive ecologies of practices, because what I'm talking about is a very dynamic, complex, self-organizing system. You need a very complex and dynamic set of practices for addressing that problem of ameliorating the self-deception and restoring and perhaps enhancing the connectedness that's at the core of our cognitive agency. So that those processes that do that, I call wisdom, and the result it gives us or is enhanced meaning in life. Because when we take a look in the psychology about what meaning and life is, when we're trying to replace the metaphor with actual science, we find that it's these kinds of connections. People, they need the world to be connected well together. They need to, right, they need to care for things and matter to things beyond themselves. And they need to know that other things are connected and mattering to them, right? And so cultures across time and history have created ecologies of practices for the cultivation of wisdom and the enhancement of meaning. And then you have to situate that culturally. Our cognition is not just individual. It's always mostly distributed. That's why your podcast came out of your conversation. And so we need ecologies of practices that coordinate, right, the cultivation of wisdom, the amelioration, right, of self-deception, the enhancement of meaning in life, and do this both individually and collectively in a cultural manner. And religions have done that in the past. Religions have created the home for the ecologies of practices. But for a lot of historical reasons, what we call the West, and it's not clear who is in the West and who isn't in the West, but anyways, the West has lost its culture, its religious worldview. At least it's lost it officially. So one of the fastest growing groups of people are the nuns, N-O-N-E-S. These are people who on census say they have no official religious affiliation. Now, that doesn't mean they're all sitting around being sort of smug new atheists or anything like that. If you take a look at the demographics, they're off doing all kinds of spiritual practices. They're spiritual but not religious, which is the most common descriptor people give to themselves these days, right? And so what they're saying is, well, I do need all of this, but I don't trust any of the organized religions or the organized political ideologies because they've smeared the world in blood. And so I'm going to do this on my own, all alone, autodidactically, in a fragmented fashion. And that largely isn't going to work because that kind of practice is most liable to be actually infected by those self-deceptive processes we've talked about. So people are hungry for wisdom and meaning in life. And the meaning crisis is they don't know where to turn for it. And very often what they turn to is, because they can't not turn to it, they displace it onto very often unhealthy practices that, you know, don't really benefit them. And so that's the meaning crisis.
So there are many things which we also relate to and which we also talk about on our podcast. Are the features of the meaning crisis like too much information and chaos and basically having problem of getting the signal out of that, getting the relevant information? Okay. And then this it's also important.
But can I add one thing?
Yes.
It's not only a wealth of information. Mm. It's also a diminishment in our capacities for improving ourselves to deal with the increase.
Oh,
right. So it's both that you're getting the increasing, you know, the increasing amount of information and the pollution of information. Because with the increasing information, there's also an exponentially increasing misinformation, right? And people are simultaneously losing the place where they can train an enhancement of the relevance realization to compensate for that. So I think there's two poles to it.
Okay. Yeah. And then I think it's important because sometimes it might sound I'm always asking, how does a person who is listening to you for the first time, how does someone relate to that? I think he has to have some experience maybe with meditation or with some of these practices, and he is interested in the topic. That's why he's listening. But also, I think that this is really important to mention, that this is related to every human being, basically, because it's the fundamental process that he's going through from the time when he was born. And that's really important, I think, for us and for me to realize that it's happening all the time. And now I can realize it and then work with it. So how does this relate to ordinary human being who is just maybe going to work and he wants to get some of these practices or some of the wisdom and make sense of the world? How does it affect him, the meaning crisis?
Let's take a metaphor here of sort of realizing that, like, almost like a disease. I'm going to use it. And so you have two parts. You want a diagnosis and you want a prognosis, right? And notice that the word gnosis is in the middle of both those words, because gnosis is ultimately participatory transformative knowing. And so I'm going to use that analogy because invoking gnosis is also helpful. So what that person should do is first look carefully at a diagnosis of the symptoms. Look for things. I'm sure most people are not sitting there going, yeah, I've had the thought that there's a meaning crisis, right? Of course not. That's ridiculous, right? But most people, you know, when they have a bunch of symptoms, unless they have any medical experience, they're not going to say, oh, yes, I think I have blah, 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 blah. They'll just, it just doesn't feel right. Something's off, right? And so pay attention to ways in your life or the people that your lives are touching. Some of these things you might be noticing, we know, you know, and it's happening. Maybe you're not touched by it directly, but it's not that far away. In areas of the world, especially weirdly in areas that are affluent, we're seeing a spike, especially among young people, of suicide. And we're seeing more self-harming. I bet you know somebody, or you at least know somebody who knows somebody who's been cutting themselves. What's going on? Do you see any other organism on the planet doing that? So, you know, you've got all these mental health issues. Why? Maybe your kids. What? So much more anxiety, so much more depression, so much, right? And we know that social media is making all of those things much worse, right? Good evidence that it's really bad for your mental health. Or how about maybe you have a kid, or maybe yourself, or you know somebody, they're getting addicted to the video games or social media. They're spending more and more time in, right, the virtual world. It's called the virtual exodus, and not as much time in the real world. Why? Well, what are they missing in the real world that they're finding and getting addicted to in the virtual world? What's going on there? Or maybe you noticed, maybe not in yourself, but in other people, more and more of your friends are getting caught up in conspiracy theories or weird, they're becoming more and more, more politically radical in ways that doesn't make sense. Like, what's going on there? And you're looking around and you're seeing all of that and you feel like there's something, things just aren't right. And there seems to be a disjunct between, it seems like we're living in two worlds. There's this scientific worldview that seems so rational and makes so much sense. And then we're living our lives, which seems to be filled with bullshit and mythology and religious forces that we like, and we don't even recognize. And we're doing, like, what the heck is going on? So that's the diagnosis. But then you might look a little bit more at a positive diagnosis and say, why is there all this interest in Buddhism? Why is Stoicism becoming such a big thing again? Why are people, including scientists, getting so interested in psychedelic experience and mystical experience? What's going on there? Well, if you put this all together, the diagnosis tells you that even though you might not have had the thought, the meaning crisis is around you. And it's probably within you in ways you don't fully realize. And so I think you're right. I think we're always perennially vulnerable to it, because as you said, it's just part of how, well, as I argued, it's part of our cognitive machinery. But once you do the diagnosis, then you have to ask yourself, well, what's the prognosis? What do I do? Well, if you don't do anything, it's going to get worse, I predict, because it seems to just be getting worse, right? So you need some intervention. So I think what you should think about doing is to taking up a core basic ecology of practices that has three aspects, or maybe four aspects, what I should say, sorry. You should be doing a mindfulness practice to enhance the way in which your attention and your awareness may be distorting your cognition. You should take up a practice of active open-mindedness. You can either do CBT, or you can take up active open-mindedness. You can teach yourself to look for cognitive biases and actively counteract them so that you can see the way in which your inferential processes are distorting your cognition. You should take up a sensory motor practice like Tai Chi Chuan or yoga, because most of your cognition is happening below the level of your explicit propositional thought and most of the connectedness. And if you can get into the flow state with these practices, it'll start to awaken you to what it feels like to be transformatively connected to the world. And then you should take up a discourse practice where you get together with people who are already on the journey like you, and you get into a practice like circling, or what Chris Mastropietro and I are doing work on, dialectic into dialogos, or authentic relating. There's no coincidence that all of these modalities are now springing up all over the world because people are trying to create these. So if you get a mindfulness practice, an active open-mindedness practice, a sensory motor flow practice, and a discourse dialogos or dialectic practice, you guys are already doing it, it sounds like, naturally, and people do have a natural capacity for it, you will start to wake up. You will start to wake up from the meaning crisis.
Okay, thank you for that. That was exactly what I was going for, the symptoms mainly, and this kind of short list of practices that everyone can do to actually start to awaken. And now you've mentioned for the first time awaken from the meaning crisis, which is also name of your lectures on YouTube. One of the things, where can people get the kind of practices and information about it, is your Discord channel, actually, which is going to be link to it is going to be in the description of the podcast. Which is great. There are circling practices. People are there talking about these topics, and it's really a lively place to be and to actually get some insight and wisdom and actually train all these things. So thank you for creating that. You are there as well. And you have also every week practice of meditation for a few minutes, and then you do Q&A and kind of a cultivation of wisdom. So that's also great. I've been to some of those, and it's been a great experience every time. So there's going to be a link to your YouTube channel as well.
Great.
And now I would like to go actually into some of the detail of awakening from the meaning crisis, how to awaken. And maybe could you start by something you already mentioned, and it was the lost ways of knowing, other ways of knowing rather than propositional saying names and facts and remembering those, but also maybe living them, as we were talking about. That's part of really important thing that we should do, not only talk about it but also live them.
Well, thank you. I mean, the series has two parts to it. And I think this is how I also think you should do great. Well, I'm not saying it was great, but I'm saying, to my model, very good science combines history and science together when you're trying to understand a phenomena. Because I think of phenomena as dynamical systems. And when you're studying a dynamical system, its history and its functionality are completely interwoven. You can't separate one from the other. So the first half of the series is a historical argument. How did we get here? And then the second is the historical side. And then the second is the scientific, the functioning side. And it's interesting because that history, in the history, you can see the loss of the other kinds of knowing and the rise to sort of an abstraction and almost tyranny of propositional knowing as being completely identified with all kinds of knowing. And then what the cognitive science has been doing is restoring us, helping us to remember what these other kinds of knowing are. So the kind we're familiar with is because it's so enmeshed with language and scientific theory, it's propositional knowing. You know things by having beliefs, hopefully, that are well justified, well argued, and well evidenced about propositions. Like, I believe that cats are mammals. There we go. That's propositional knowing. I believe that, and here's a proposition: cats are mammals. And if it's working, if it's putting me in touch with reality, then it's true. I have a sense of conviction that it's true, right? And we try and enhance that sense of conviction when we try to justify our claims through science and et cetera. And that has a particular kind of memory associated with it, namely semantic memory. So I just called on it. I have this memory that cats are mammals. There isn't a point in my life that points back to, yes, I remember. It was on June 22nd, right, that cats are mammals. That was the day. It's not an event, that it's a semantic thing, like Africa is a continent, right? And even if you did remember the episode, that episode is irrelevant to the memory. So, right? Now, you also have a different kind of knowing. You have procedural knowing, which is knowing how to do something. This is your ability to coordinate very complex, multiple simultaneous variables in your sensory motor interaction with the world. Like when I catch a ball, or I ride a bike, or I'm sparring with somebody in Tai Chi, I know how to do it. And there, the end result isn't a theory. The end result is a skill. And skills put me in touch with reality, not by giving me a sense of conviction, like that's true. I don't even know what that would be like in martial arts. What I get is a sense of power. Power, right? And we know that, we now know, in fact, that you have a different kind of memory associated with this. It's called procedural memory. And you can lose your semantic memory or large parts of it, and your procedural memory will be completely untouched. Like, you know, think about people who, you know, some people will have dramatic amnesia, or they'll get brain damage and they lose their semantic memory, but they'll remember how to play the piano or to walk around the room, right? So I'm going to do that for each one of you. I'm going to show you what it does, how it works, what its normative standards are, and the kind of memory associated with it. Okay, now, if I'm going to apply a skill, what do I need? Let's go both ways. If I'm going to apply a skill or acquire a skill, what do I need? Well, I need to know what's called situational awareness, right? And that has to do with my perspective on a situation, what I'm foregrounding, what I'm backgrounding, what I'm considering important, what I'm treating as important, what I'm treating as irrelevant. Like the wall behind you is not in your perspective right now until I mentioned it to you, right? So you're doing what I call salience landscaping. Various things are standing out, and these two things are interdefining. You have a state of mind and a salience landscape, and they're mutually interdefining. So if you were drunk, you'd have a different salience landscape. Or if I dramatically change your salience landscape, it'll put you into a different state of mind. And think about how that happens even when you shift from one emotion to another. If you suddenly got angry, your state of mind would change, and correspondingly your salience landscape would change. So that's what I mean by perspectival knowing. It's your sense of here, nowness, salience, and state of mind, all coordinated together with this wonderful metaphor of a perspective. And so you know what it is like to be you here now in this state of mind. It's happening right now. And of course, that overlaps a lot with consciousness and working memory. Now, what's the sense of realness there? It's not so much power, because you're not really doing anything. And it's not so much conviction of truth, because you're not claiming anything. What is it? Well, interestingly enough, video games give us a really good place to study that, because what people are looking for is what they call a sense of presence, a sense of really being in the game, really here and now. So I've been doing a lot of work with Dan Chiappi about scientists moving the rovers around on Mars and how they get the sense of being on Mars, even though they're on Earth, right? And really studying that. So, and do we have a form of memory associated with perspectival knowing? You bet. I mentioned it earlier. Episodic memory. You remember scenes. What's a scene? It's a here now, right? Perspective on a particular situation. I remember what it was like to be there then, in that state of mind. That's your episodic memory. Now, below it, and this is the one that's most difficult for people to access, is the one that makes all the other ones possible, which is participatory knowing. And participatory knowing is the way in which biological evolution, cultural evolution, and your own ongoing neurological evolution fit you and the world together, create what are called affordances. This object is graspable by me, right? Biological evolution, right, has shaped me to grasp objects of a certain shape, right? But right, cultural evolution has given me the practice of talking on the phone, right? And the technology has shaped the environment and me. So this mutual shaping of environment and organism, biological, cultural, cognitive, creates affordances. It gives you your fundamental sense of belonging, that you're at home in the world. It's your participatory knowing. And it doesn't result in a theory or a skill or even a perspective. It results in all of what you're doing right now, all the identifications that are happening. You're assuming an identity and you're assigning identity. All these identities are just springing up around you. Because affordances are basically nexus points. Sorry, identities are basically nexus points within affordances, an affordance network, you know? And so do you have a kind of memory that's associated with that? Yeah. But if you don't even recognize it as memory, it's that deep. It's your sense of self. That's your self. That's, right, that's the memory that I'm talking about. And we know that that can be damaged or fractured. And it seems to have specific areas in the brain where it's also operating. Now, those, the three lower P's, because I think of them as below propositional, the procedural, the perspectival, and the participatory, that's where most of your relevance realization is going on. And to the degree to which you're cut off from it is the degree to which it's operating, but it's operating for you in a disconnected and fragmented way.
When I was listening to lectures, I've written sort of a pyramid of those types, yeah, types of knowing. Yeah. It feels like that, as you said, on the bottom there is the participatory, then right, then there is the perspectival, then there is the procedural, right, and then there, yeah, is the propositional at the top.
Yep.
And it's the, yes, smallest part, the propositional.
Yes.
But
yes,
it feels like our culture, it switched the participatory with the proposition, and it, yeah, made the base of the pyramid out of the propositions.
Yes, and it's tried to do that. It's tried, uh-huh, with, and that can't work because the propositional knowledge is deeply presupposes and deeply dependent on the procedural knowledge. Mm-hmm. So like you're uttering propositions here to me. And of course the propositional knowing is making inference about the implication relations between those propositions. But notice that depends on your procedural abilities of carrying out a conversation, mm-hmm, and of conveying information beyond everything you're saying and of coordinating like you're doing right now, you're nodding with previous speech acts that you've made and how you're actually adjusting your, so you have all these skills. Well, what's activating the skills in the right? Your sense of the situation and how you're present in it and the degree to which you feel I'm present or absent or not into it. And then what's underneath that? Well, all of the affordances that are opened up by the fact that we're all biologically human beings, we're all Homo sapiens, and that means we're fitted to each other in profound ways and all kinds of affordances. Notice that you're looking largely at my face and not at my shoulder. Who taught you to do that? Okay? The babies come, like I can draw a circle with three dots in it and babies will stare at it because it's like a face. Okay, that's what I mean. All of that upper level stuff is complete, and that of course makes evolutionary sense. You know, creatures that could use language and work in propositional space, in logical, that's very recent. It's us. But we didn't Big Bang out of nothing. There's literally hundreds of millions of years of evolution that have made that upper level of the pyramid possible for us. Yeah, and so we're trying to live almost this inverted life. And that, notice, I like what you said about how we have, how we've conflated the propositional with the participatory. It's like we identify with our beliefs, that I am my beliefs, and that, you know, and notice how we've even turned the idea of religion, which religio originally meant to connect. We've turned that, oh, well, religion is a system of beliefs. No, it's not. In fact, most cultures don't even have a separate word for religion. They don't have a separate concept. Being a meaning-making cultural thing and using rituals to tap the procedural and all that, that's just part of being a human being for them. But we've over-identified with, I call it the monological mind. We have a cognitive monoculture, and each one of us are just little monologues in that monoculture. And all we're doing is running around speaking, and that's all in who and what we are. And one of the dangers that we're facing is ideologies really, really tap into that and exacerbate that. You are just what you believe. And all that matters about you is having the right beliefs. And I frankly think that's bullshit. Do your beliefs matter? Of course they do. But you know what also matters? Your skills, your state of mind, all of your biological and cultural and cognitive processes that create your sense of self and identity, both individually and collectively, all of that is being ignored at the ideological level.
It looks like that from these beliefs, we made some automatic frames that we take like for granted.
Yes.
And you often talk about insight and the role what insight plays in like breaking these automatic reactions. And you talk about insight with connection to optimizing your cognition for insight.
Yes.
Can you talk a little bit about this?
Yeah, that's excellent. Thank you, Christoph. Yeah, so, right. I'm sure you've all had it. You've all had the aha moment. Right, you've had the moment where you go, oh, what? And you realize that your perspectival knowing was wrong. You got a sense of that you've misframed the problem. So people are, and understandably so, people tend to fixate on the answer to a problem, and they don't do much training on becoming aware of how they formulated a problem. Formulating a problem is, right, one way you can think about that even practically is, how often do you step back and look at the question you're asking rather than the answer that immediately comes to mind and then getting into debates about the answers, right? Even at the propositional level, because questioning is weird because it bridges between the perspectival and the propositional, right? When you step back and you're aware that you've misframed something, when you call it into question, like we say, what's happening? Well, you realize that when you go, aha, and you have that flash, you realize that you were considering one part of this really relevant and it turned out to be irrelevant. That's not the important thing. Actually, this was the important thing. And you realize that you've misidentified things. You've given them the wrong identity. Oh, I was treating that as a solid line, and I should have treated that as a broken line, as a permeable barrier. Right? You do all these things all the time. And so what you do in an insight is you have this simultaneous, it goes in both directions. You have an awareness of how you have misframed a situation, like you were saying, Christoph, but you're aware of it only in transformation. It's one of those transformational truths. You're aware that you've misframed the situation because another framing has become available to you simultaneously, and that's why it's a flash, with how the world is now disclosing itself to you, showing itself to you in a new and different way. That's why it's aha, and it's realization. That's why I use the word in both senses of the word. You're coming to a new understanding, but the world is now more is being actualized towards you in a new way. It's acting on you in a new way it couldn't act on you before. And so you realize, wait, I'm thinking of Dorothy as my mother. Oh, no, right? Right, and you get all that, right? And notice what that does for you. And I chose a therapeutic insight rather than just a cognitive insight, because that kind of insight reaches down into your sense of self, right? And how you're identifying with and of other people, how you're identifying Dorothy or identifying with Dorothy even, right? And so insights help you to break out of ways in which we, in which the relevance realization has boxed us in and is causing us to find the wrong information salient in the wrong way, such that we can't achieve the goals that we want to achieve. And so insight is, I think, the primary experience of the kind of truths that are only disclosed in transformation. And an insight is typically not coming up with, it's not like discovering information you didn't have. It's almost always that you've reconfigured the relevance of the information you always knew was there, but, right? You always knew it was there. You just have to change it around. And so for me, that's at the core of wisdom. That's why we think of insight, especially not just conceptual insight, but participatory and perspectival and somebody who has a lot of procedural, they know how to interact really insightfully, regularly, and perspectival. They get the right perspectives and they get into the right state of mind, right state of consciousness, and participatory. They can reach into the processes of people's identities and transform them. Those people that have that kind of insight, wouldn't you call them wise? I would. And so I think that ability to transform salience so that we can get out of the deepest boxes that we're in, that's the core of wisdom. And I think that's a profound kind of insight.
So putting all those things together, it feels like, because we are kind of stuck in this one kind of knowing, not yeah. only, obviously, we wouldn't be able to kind of move through the world, but it's too much of the one kind of knowing. It creates those basically frames that are in patterns which are not related to reality that much.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
you need to break them up and create new ones with insight.
Yes.
That we grip reality in a better kind of way closer
exactly.
to reality.
Yes, well said. That's exactly what I'm talking about. And so, yeah. It's not that the proposition. We're not trying to eradicate the propositional knowing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
When we make a new frame, we'll need to articulate it mm-hmm. and communicate it, right? But what we could do is not think that. Right, that's where where the main show is. And secondly, we shouldn't think that any propositional representation is going to get us to the ultimate final frame in which no other framing of reality is ever needed. And this is another claim of ideologies that I find pernicious, because I think, right, and you can probably see it at least intuitively, I've made the argument explicitly and published it, but the process of relevance realization is deeply analogous to biological evolution. Right, what your brain is doing is constantly creating variations in what it considers salient and relevant, and then putting them under selective pressure as to which ones get me to my goal. And it's constantly like variation and selection. And it's constant. And think about biological evolution. It doesn't stop. There isn't a final, well, that's it. We finally got the final species, because there's no such thing. There is no species that is capable of being adaptively fit to all environments across time and space, right? Evolution keeps going. There isn't a final solution. And if the propositions become tyrannical in two ways, they say, we're the whole show and we've got the final framing, that's when we're most in trouble. And the thing that troubles me is that way of thinking is becoming more and more prominent and more prevalent on left and right. I don't care about the sides of the political spectrum. This kind of propositional tyranny is becoming more pronounced, prevalent, and pervasive. And it's exacerbating the meaning crisis for those reasons. Sorry, I'm getting very passionate about this.
That's great.
This is where I'm starting to sense the suffering that is happening.
Yes.
Right?
We've been talking a lot about biological evolution and how it doesn't know the exponential growth. And we are around 25 and we've been born into this really, really fast transformation in past, it's been past hundreds, 200 years, but the biological system is the same for past, I don't know, 20,000 years maybe. So therefore it is kind of set up to do the biggest work in setting up the grip of the world, how actually to make sense of the world during the first 10 to 20 years. But nowadays I've been born into some world. I've been getting information. I've been trying to make sense. I've been getting strategies to make sense. But then in after 20s, 30s, I'm actually living in a different world than I've been born to, which is really interesting. And if you think what you were saying on the kind of level of society, I think is happening also in the individual as well.
Very much.
The person, like I thought of this kind of meta insight, which would allow me to actually develop and mature in the world and grip the world optimally and make sense of it after, like during my lifetime. And it's the simplest thing ever, is that I'm not at any point sure how the world is, and I didn't come to final destination yet. It's where I die, I come to final destination. Therefore, when I live, I try to make sense of the world, and there is no point of me being like, oh, I figured it out. I need to live, and living is figuring out how to live, actually, how to make sense. And this is something which Raphael Morgan also calls ego actualization, which is really nice kind of term. Is this something which is connected to this kind of this
very much
differently ways of knowing, actually trying to know yourself and actualize what's happening in the world, actually realize, wow, this is the context I'm in and I need to change my sense-making system, basically, to be able to optimally work and mutually shape the world, and the world is shaping me as well. So is that something which is connected to that, the four ways of knowing and what we were talking about?
Totally, totally. So let's go back to the person that really opened me up. It's Socrates. Talk about Socratic faith, right? Because notice there's two possibilities when you know, and my friend Jordan Hall talks about this. You know, it's not only that we're getting this explosion; the rate of the explosion is also increasing, right? So, right, it's not just that things are exploding; it's that things are exploding, right? Like, right. And notice it's also longitudinally. We are exposing kids much and much earlier to social media and to cyberspace. And we know that this is having a deleterious effect. I've mentioned it. Time on Instagram and TikTok and Snapchat is really deleterious to young people's mental health. Clearly, for reasons you just articulated. Okay. So when I start to sense that, even incoherently, there's two possible responses. One is, I want somebody to give me the final frame. Right, I want somebody to take away all this noise and just give me the pure, unadulterated signal forever. Thank you, amen. Please, do it now. Right, that's one strategy. And we see an overwhelming number of people pursuing that strategy in increasing numbers. And I predict we'll see that increase as this complexification process in our world continues to increase. The other is Socratic faith. And notice what's at the core of it. What was Socrates' motto? I have it tattooed on my shoulders. Know thyself. And know thyself isn't propositional. This is what all of the scholars about Socratic dialogue and dialectic are talking about now. It's not your autobiography. It's much more, I like to say it, it's much more like your owner's manual and your operating system. You're trying to understand the procedural, perspectival, and participatory knowing that constitutes you as a cognitive agent capable of using propositions, right? And so you can see that the main goal of the Socratic project is to use propositional discourse, but to actually break it, break being locked in the frame, so that we're thrown back onto, I think, so many books on this right now. Christopher Moore's book on Socratic self-knowledge, Sarah Abel-Rappe's book on Socratic ignorance and Platonic knowledge. There's this growing powerful consensus around this idea. Drew Hyland's work on the question of beauty. Anyway, what's going on there is Socrates, he goes in and he's a master of the propositional argumentative domain. But the point of that is to break you out of it so that you have to know yourself at this deeper level. And you know yourself, but it's not just, it's a knowing that's, in, like I said, it's inherently bound up with transformation. You can only know deeply know yourself insofar as you're undergoing perspectival and procedural and participatory knowing. What is the transformation in which we're transforming our skills, our states of mind, and our state of self? It's virtue. When we're cultivating virtue, and each virtue is just learning how to be wise in a particular situation. That's why all of the Socratic dialogues are about virtue. They're about how can I actually become and be a wise person. The Socratic faith is this, that if I get on the course of philia sophia, the ardent love for wisdom and virtue, I will have the adaptivity to deal with the tsunami of information. Rather than looking for the strong man who will give me the final frame and the clear, unadulterated signal forever, thank you, amen, I want to belong, philia, to a community of people who are co-creating and co-cultivating together wisdom and virtue so that we individually and collectively, we can constantly adapt to the ever-changing information environment. That's Socratic faith. And I think Socratic faith is the only real alternative to ideological tyranny. And that's what you see all happening in Socrates. Socratic faith in competition with the ideological tyranny of the Athenians, and that's why they killed him.
That's very interesting. Thank you for that. We've been talking about these kind of steps of inside getting to better sense making, more meaning, wisdom. We are very much interested in this systemic change. Maybe we've talked about it already, the awakening experience. Could you describe what do you mean by that? Is that a single event? Could it be a single event? Is there such thing as systemic insight, and how can we get there?
Well, we know that there's systemic insight and then it occurs systematically. Because we see it in child development, right? When children move from one stage of development to the other. So it's not that they just have an insight about this problem. They have an insight. It's like it's an insight, and it's like it hits a nexus point, and it transforms a network of kinds of problems. So they have insight into a type of problem, not just this problem, right? So it's systemic in that it goes through all of their cognition, and it's systematic in that it reveals a system of problems that are addressed. So it's systematic and systemic. And we see it in child development regularly happening. That's the core of Piaget. It's even, right, the core of other models. And the interesting thing is, one of the analogies that we see used in the ancient world is, as the child is to the adult is to the sage, which is basically the argument that your development isn't done just because you become an adult. Right, you're not finished. You haven't reached the final stage. Again, like we love to think we can somehow get to the final stage, right? But the idea is no. There, you still have systems of problems that you're unaware of that require systemic transformation in your cognition to address them. But that is really possible for you. You can systemically change your cognition and realize a system of problems and overcome it. Right? And so I think that's what we're talking about when we're talking about awakening. And I use awakening because I want to capture that it's not just a change in belief. It's like a change in consciousness, a change in skill, a change even in a sense of identity. And so you're going to see, right, it's going to require systemic changes in all of the cognition. You're going to have to be learning how to change your state of mind, your consciousness, learning how to cultivate new kinds of skills, learning how to transform your sense of self and identity, and not ad hoc, but in an integrated, coordinated manner. So you get a systemic transformation that gives you an awareness of, so that you can realize and respond to, a system of problems in your life. And when you can do that very comprehensively, I think we can talk about people being awakened. Now, I think the cognitive flexibility, now this is where people, as I say more, I'll lose people that agree with me. But I think the cognitive flexibility needed, especially for us, to achieve that kind of systemic transformation that puts us in touch with a system of problems such that we can ameliorate and transform, ameliorate them, address them, and transform ourselves and the world in a coordinated fashion. I think the cognitive flexibility needed to do that requires very profound changes in one's state of consciousness. And I think there people intuitively know this, which is why people are pursuing mindfulness practices and psychedelic experiences and visualization practices and all these things in which they're trying to alter their state of consciousness because they're trying to realize a higher, what I call a higher state of consciousness, a state of consciousness that gives you that cognitive flexibility and plugs into a systemic transformation of your cognition and consciousness and character such that it plugs you into, in a powerful and effective way, the system of problems that I'm calling the meaning crisis, such that you can address and respond to them in a profound way. So I think that awakening doesn't have to be, in fact, I don't think awakening is any one experience, I think it's more probable that you will be able to address or afford, that's what I want to, you'll be able to afford the transformation I'm talking about if you have an experience, a systematic experience of a state that's simultaneously an altered state of consciousness, the training of the important skills, the altering of your sense of self so that the requisite character development is possible. I think that you have to have that kind of comprehensive thing. But I think for most people, I think there are people that were just gifted that just something happens and bang, that happens to them. and I read about them and I like, okay. Like, to me, that's like, the chances that you're just going to randomly find the amazing partner that you should spend the rest of your life with, and it turns out to be true. It could happen. It does happen. But for most of us, no, what we do is we bumble along and we, oh, here's a disastrous relationship. Oh, here's another one, right? We do that, right? So for many of us, I would argue, is although I think we need to get to those states that I'm talking about, the process of getting there is going to be an incremental process that's going to take years of practice and development. So I sort of answered your question saying sort of yes to both sides, but I tried to put it together in an appropriate way.
Yes, thank you. Now I would like to talk more deeply about meditation and mindfulness. How does being present actually leads to an insight and leads to this systemic change?
Yeah, so this goes to the work that I did with Leo Ferraro. So one of the things, the arguments we made, is you have to be really careful not to confuse the language of training and the language of explaining. There's language that I use to train people to do mindfulness, right? But it's not the same language I use to try and explain what mindfulness is scientifically. those are very different projects, and they're working towards different goals and different standards. And I often use the examples. There's many other areas of your cognition where it's apparent that how you can train a process, like training memory, that the metaphors you use for training memory or training attention actually are not the good metaphors for explaining how memory works or how attention works, right? And let's remember that mindfulness means to remember, and it has to do with attention. So, right, this is important, what I'm talking about, these connections. And so being present is about trying to come into a state where you're less representational, where you're not in representing the world. Instead, what you're trying to do is get to how the world is presencing, the here-now-ness, togetherness of the world. You're trying to come into an awareness of how your representations have been framing the world. And we've been talking about this all the way through here. You're trying to step out of propositional thinking into, right, perspectival awareness, but not just for its own sake. I mean, Arthur Dyckman has a slogan that I use a lot. It's not ultimately about altered states of consciousness. It's about altered traits of character. I step out of propositional thinking so I can step out of my automatic tyranny of my propositional thinking. I come into perspectival, right? I start to become aware of my perspectival knowing for its own sake, rather than being aware through it. I become aware of it. But I'm doing that so that the way in which my participatory knowing and my perspectival knowing touch each other allows my conscious mind to touch myself. And by that, I don't mean a soul or a substantial entity. I'm using it in a way that's neutral to whether or not you're a Buddhist or a Christian. What I mean is that part of you that's the locus of your participatory knowing. Because when I can put the machinery of participatory knowing into contact with my perspectival knowing, then I have the possibility of cultivating my character, actually training virtue and wisdom. And so in meditation, what you're doing is stepping back and looking at your framing. So I often use the metaphor because I wear glasses, right? So I'm looking through my glasses. They're transparent to me. I'm not aware of them because I'm aware through them. This is my everyday mental framing of things. And like we've saying, it can distort things. In meditation, what I can do, and I'm doing it right now with my glasses, I'm stepping back, I've taken them off my face, and I'm stepping back and looking at them, right? Because now I'm actually not looking through them. I'm looking at them. They're opaque to me. That's what you're doing in mindfulness. You're stepping back and looking at your mind. But notice that if that's all I ever did, that would be very problematic, right? Oh, there's a distortion. Well, how do you know it's a distortion? Well, this is what I do with my glasses. Oh, I think there's some grime. I clean my glasses, and am I satisfied? I'm just going to keep cleaning my glasses. No, what do? I put my glasses on and see if I can now see the world better than I did before. That's contemplation. So meditation is stepping back. Contemplation is now trying to look more deeply into the world, and the two have to go together, right? You have to step back to see if your mental framing is distorting things. Then you have to transform your mental framing and step back through it to see if you're seeing the world better. Are you getting more of an optimal grip on the world? Are you less prone to self-deception? Are you more capable of cultivating virtue? Are you experiencing for yourself and generating for others more meaning in life? So you have to do contemplative practices and meditative practices. This is what I mean by you always have to engage in an ecology of practices. If you look at mindfulness practices in situ, in the place where they culturally originated, you'll find that you're very rarely just sort of sitting and doing meditation. You're doing contemplative practices, moving practices, virtue training practices. Think about the Eightfold Path in Buddhism. You have to do this complex ecology of practices. So there's an ecology of practices within mindfulness, and I was fortunate to be taught those. I was taught meditation, contemplation, and Tai Chi Chuan. There's an ecology of practices within mindfulness, but that ecology has to itself be situated in a larger ecology of practices dedicated to the cultivation of wisdom.
Where does this kind of scaling down of where you put your attention, what you actually are seeing through,
Oh,
where does it end? Where does it lead? What kind of experience can we have there, if there is some?
There are. I mean, so if I ask you, like say you're touching an object and you're feeling the object, you can feel the object, you know what it is. Here's my TV remote. But I can say, well, but can you right now you're feeling the remote, but instead of feeling the remote, can you actually pay attention to what's happening in your fingers and your thumbs? And you can do that, right? Mm-hmm. And then I can say, well, can you pay attention, right, to the sensations that are happening? And some people can do that.
I'm sorry, can we actually do it with the listeners to
sure.
experience?
Yeah, okay. So a good thing to do is pick up an object. Now you have to do a little bit of pretense here, and we're going to use touch because it's better, it's slower than sight. So you're going to pick up an object that you're going to use like as your probe. Mm-hmm. And this goes back to independently, Michael Polanyi and Marlo Ponte. They both got this from the idea of how a blind person uses a cane to sense the world mm-hmm. by tapping. Okay, so you're gonna get an object. You can either hold it in your hand and put it in front of you. Now, before we start, it's really important that you listen to my instructions. I'm gonna ask you to don't start. I'm gonna ask you to tap the object to try and figure out what the object is. Okay, you know what that is. That's what a blind person learns to do, and you can already do it. Now, keep tapping no matter what I say. Okay, keep doing the tapping. Okay, so let's do it. Don't look at it or close your eyes and start tapping the object. Okay, and now you're getting aware of the object, okay? Now keep tapping the object, but shift your awareness into your pencil or your pen. And you can feel how your pencil or pen is moving, stopping and starting, moving around. Okay, now keep tapping and move your awareness into your fingers and your thumb and your hand and how it's moving and changing and contorting, making that possible. Now if you can, try to become aware just of the sensations that are happening. That last one's hard. Okay, now come back. Feel your thumb and your fingers. Feel your pencil or pen. And now feel the object that you're tapping on. Okay, were you able to do that?
Yep.
Okay, so notice what's happening. And this is what you're learning to do in meditation. So you're tapping on your object, and you're aware of the object, right? You're not aware of your probe. You're aware through your probe. But then I made you aware of your probe. Right? You were aware of the probe by being aware through your fingers. And then I made you aware of your fingers, right? But how are you aware of your fingers? What are you aware through? Well, you're aware through your consciousness. And I can make you aware just of your awareness. You can do it right now. Are you conscious? Yes. You're aware of your awareness. So you can step all the way back and get into a where you're just aware of your awareness. And then you step back one notch more in which you're in just pure awareness. This is called the pure consciousness event. That's where meditation. And then you can't step out of that, because to step out of that would be to step out of awareness. And you would be, well, unconscious. So, but notice you went the other way. You went from your fingers back into the pen, back into the object, right? But you can stop, right? Well, here's tools. And now you're not so much looking at them, you're looking at the class. You're looking through them. That's what the word theory actually originally meant, looking deeply into the world. In contemplative practices, we practice going the other way. Like, sit back and try to realize, remember, how the world is actually not static. Everything is constantly changing around you. And that everything is actually causally interconnected. Everything is massively interconnected and in your room and changing. But that room is sitting inside of a building, inside of a city, inside of a world, inside of a solar system. And the rates of change are not only in seconds, but millions. And right? So you can practice scaling down in meditation to the pure consciousness event, and you can practice scaling up until you feel, and maybe you got a taste of it just a moment ago, that resonant at one mint with all things. But that's actually not the goal of the practices. Because if I stop meditating. That's just me just always looking at my glasses and never correcting them. And the other one is me always looking through and not checking to see if I'm looking through rose-colored glasses. I want, because what happens in an aha? In an aha, you simultaneously are aware of your mental framing as you transform it and of a new depth of the world as you transform it. You want to be going both ways. So if we had a systemic insight that captured a systematic transformation, we would be going simultaneously. We would be simultaneously scaling up and scaling down to the most comprehensive aha that we can have. That's prajna. That's the cognitive flexibility that makes awakening possible.
Well, thank you for the description. This is so interesting and so mind-blowing and fascinating. For us, it's been always really interesting to talk about actually about the participatory nature of all things, of of us as well. And from the brain point of view, you move through the world, and the world is moving through you. It's shaping you, and there's the mutual shaping. And it's really interesting that you can realize this in kind of intellectual way, and then there is this other part of other type of knowing that you can actually do the practices to experience it, to actually have some sense of belonging, have sense of being a part of this thing, and mutual shaping, reciprocal kind of opening and co-identification, and all these things is that I'm part of the world, and the world isn't something different. It's not like it's me and the world. It's me, the world, and we are from the same stuff at the kind of basic level. That's for us has been really important to talk about deeply, to actually to feel it at some point afterwards, after the talks, after the realization. You can go into meditation or like thinkitation and contemplation, and you can start to feel these things, because they are just super interesting and fascinating. So thank you for this description. It blows my mind.
And there is one interesting thing I would like to add, because our point of where we were starting is that we were talking about the world in terms of science. We were studying science, biology, how the trees how the trees are working, how the what are the air like, compounds in the air, and how they are affecting us, and we are affecting them, and it's affecting trees. And so we get to this state of wellness basically through just the science facts and realizations and insights in this field.
Well, that's thank you for sharing that, because that's why I'm so interested in Neoplatonism, which came out of the Socratic tradition. Because in Neoplatonism, you find woven together seamlessly the two things. You find them trying to come up with the best scientific conceptual account, while also simultaneously, they're woven together, going through like a mindfulness practice, right? And like when you're reading Plotinus or Proclus or Damasius, right? It's just seamless like that. And so that's why I'm so fascinated, not because I think we can all go back to ancient Greece or anything ridiculous like that. I'm interested in maybe something like a naturalistic Neoplatonism, a form of Neoplatonism that emerges, that was like Neoplatonism in its manner. It might not necessarily have the same thing, but, doing that, can we build up, right? Can we simultaneously, in an integrated fashion, build up the best schema of intelligibility that's also the ladder by which we ascend in self-transcendence? And that's what I'm interested in doing, and that's why I'm so fascinated by the Neoplatonists. And we should take note of the fact that that's why I think the Neoplatonists, I think Verslewis is absolutely right on this. The Neoplatonists, they form the cultural cognitive grammar of Western spirituality. All the spiritual traditions go back and tap into and appropriate and sometimes misappropriate the Neoplatonic tradition. That's why I'm so fascinated by it. And not, again, again, not theoretically. I want to try and reinventio, that word that I'm doing with Andrew Sweeney and Chris Mastropietro, these practices as much as possible for us now. So you guys could do what you just talked about, Christoph. You could do it profoundly and deeply and reliably and shareably with other people.
Yeah, that's fine, because that's the place where the objective reality of studying things meets the subjective reality, because you just can't get rid of your subjective experience. It's just part of the process.
That's right. All right. So that's why I've been trying to talk about transjectivity as that which grounds the connection between them and makes them possible. Yeah, exactly.
Mm. There is one other work of Eric Fromm I really like. You've talked about it as well. Could you describe it? Mode and having mode.
So first of all, let's take note of what mode is, because it's an existential mode. Mm-hmm. And what he means is that stack from the propositional through the procedural perspectival down to the participatory, because an existential mode is that process of mutual shaping between you and the world. And Chris and I and Philip, we use the metaphor of the agent arena relationship, the particular agency that you're invoking right now. So right now I'm invoking my professorial teacher science agency, right? Because what arena am I moving in? I'm moving in the science spirituality arena. I wouldn't, if I met you on the street and you asked me for directions, and I adopt that agency and try to put you in that arena, it would freak you out, right? Because we've got this nested, dynamical, shuffling hierarchy or system of agencies that we're constantly doing this with, so that we can constantly refit ourselves to an arena. So when that is working, when the participatory, so the agent arena co-identification is fitting you and the world together, such that you're in the right state of mind that activates, right, or acquires the right skills, so that you are capable of, you know, doing the right interactions with your fellow people and doing good knowledge, propositional knowledge generation. That's your existential mode. That's a mode, right? So, all right. So, and then Fromm's idea was, we have modes are organized around, and this goes back to relevance. Things are always about relevance is always relevance to an organism that has needs. This is why my computer can't do relevance realization. It's not making itself. Nothing, listen to my words, nothing literally matters to it, but lots matters to me. Lots is import to me, because I have needs. Because I am something that is making itself. The computer isn't making itself. At all these levels, from the participatory upward, I'm an autopoetic, making things, so I have needs. So all of my existential modes, all my relevance realization within those modes is directed towards satisfying needs. And what Fromm argued is that there's two fundamental kinds of needs. And we've been touching on them a lot, right? There are needs that are met by having. What he means by that is, these are needs, they're largely homeostatic needs. They are needs that are met by, like, that literal kind of mattering, by getting control, right? Getting really, you know, control, often for the point of consumption, over like water, air, right? Even sex, because we have this weird idea that we consummate sex. There's a consumption. And you know, and I realize, you know, that's problematic, but there's that we feel it like a physiological need, right? We have needs for shelter. So the having needs are met by controlling, potentially consuming things to varying degrees. Well, what kind of identity do I want to assume and assign to the world in order to do that? Well, I want to see the world as manipulable things, controllable things. And I want to put myself in the role, I want to sort of design my agency, activate my agency in a form that will allow me to control and manipulate. So what I'm doing now is I'm trying to solve problems, and I'm trying to do that so I can control and manipulate things. So what's going to help me in that is if I can give things the identities that make them easily manipulatable, which means replaceable. So this is a pencil. which means if I lose it, I know readily how to replace it and get control of another thing that's equally as good as it, right? And there's nothing wrong with the having mode. If you're incapable of getting in the having mode, you're going to be dead about 4 days from now, right? So, like, okay. Now, there's other needs you have, and these have to do with the fact that you are not just a biological being. You are a cultural person. You're a cultural person. And we're weird things. We're primates that turn out to be persons, as my friend Greg Enriquez likes to say, okay? So we have developmental needs. We have needs that are met by becoming a particular kind of person. These are needs of maturation and development, right? So these are needs that are met by going through an aspirational process, the developmental process, the transformative process, right? So let's do that. You need to be mature. You need to become an adult, okay? You could eat as much as you want, and you can drink as much as you want, and you could even have as much sex as you want, and control as much stuff as you want, and that won't turn you into an adult, right? That won't turn you into an adult. Instead, what do you have to do? Well, it's not about manipulating or consuming things in the world. It's about coming to, right, a way of transforming the agent-arena relationship. It's about changing who you are and how the world can be so that you have a more deeper and comprehensive life, way of being. So that's why we all need to become good people. It's such a vague idea, right? But think about how powerfully it drives you. You know, I doubt that you're talking with me because you think this will have anything to do with your food consumption, your getting water, your, you know, having more sex, you're getting more shelter. Ultimately, you're trying to make meaning to become a better person. You're trying to continue growing up, waking up, all these metaphors of growing up and waking up. So those developmental needs put you in a different relationship. They're not about treating things categorically. They're about realizing how your identity is being shaped and the identity of things is being shaped and how meaningful that can be for you, how that can be an arena for development and transformation. And so I want to treat things and even, well, people, sorry, and even things differently in the being mode. So think about how you treat here's a physical object and I treat it in the having mode. But what if I was to paint it as a work of art? Was the painting now different? Now I'm trying to get at, how is this meaning to you? A good artist, think about, you know, Van Gogh painting some shoes, as Heidegger famously pointed out. The point isn't, oh yeah, I could use those shoes, haha, right? You've missed the painting. The point is you're coming into the being mode and you're trying to realize the meaning making that is going on and the way reality and you are disclosing to each other. And when we come into human beings, we want to get into this reciprocal disclosure. You mentioned it earlier, reciprocal opening, right? We want to come ultimately to love people. And I don't just mean sexually. I mean also friendship, right? And agapic, like how I love my children. I don't mean this in an incorrect sense or inappropriate, how I love my students, because I'm trying to give to them the affordance and make the meaning that will help them to become better persons. Now the difficulty is, what we can get into, both modes are absolutely legitimate and needed and necessary for a good life. If you had only the being mode, you'd be starving to death, right? If you had only the having mode, you're gonna be an infantile, immature, narcissistic asshole, right? Now, our problem, according to Fromm, and there's important cultural drivers for this, is we get modal confusion. We pursue a set of needs from the wrong existential mode. And the one that he's most concerned about, because he thinks our capitalist system, he's a Marxist, I'm not advocating Marxism here, but it's a legitimate critique, right? If you just think capitalism is the final answer, I don't really want to talk to you because you're just doing all of that stuff we've already said is mistaken. It has its benefits, it has its negatives, right, etc. So that's all I'm going to say about any of that political bullshit. Okay, so what Fromm was concerned about is that we're often being led and even manipulated and deceived into trying to satisfy our being needs from the having mode. I need to become mature so I have lots of sex, or I consume some alcohol, right? Or here's one in North America. I don't know if it's where you guys are, but what I'll do is I'll get a car because that means I'm mature, right? I'll get a car. I'll get my own place, which might help, but you know what I mean. And you need to be in love. You need to fall in love, reciprocally opening with other human beings. Well, I'll have lots of contacts. I'll have lots of friends on social media. That'll do it. That'll do it. And they'll just confirm everything I believe. They won't make me reciprocally open and develop. In fact, they'll do the exact opposite. They'll try as much as possible to keep me locked into, right? And we'll mutually lock into each other into a non-changing set of beliefs. And oh, by the way, instead of becoming more meaningful, I'm going to have as many beliefs as I want. And I'm going to have as much stuff as I possibly can. I'm going to have as many connections. I'm not going to fall in love. I'm going to have as much sex as I can. And of course, what happens is you don't get any of the being needs met. And so you're frustrated. You're really deeply frustrated. And so what you do is think, I just didn't do it fast enough. I just didn't get enough stuff. I didn't have enough sex. I need more contacts. I need to be on my phone more. I need more. I need to do it more and more and more. And of course, that can just keep going until you get into a massive kind of addictive state. And that's another symptom of the meaning crisis, the addiction crises that are just proliferating around the world. Or you can come to say, the whole thing's rigged. It's all rigged. And Fromm warned about this. The only answer is to tear it all down, smash it, go into the streets, let's smash stuff, let's destroy everything, because at least I'm acting authentically. But that's still to be trapped in modal confusion. The idea is to do the transformation of skill, of states of consciousness, traits of character, so that you remember the being mode, so that you wake up out of modal confusion. That's Fromm.
It's like when you are changing perspective on ordinary things, it's like the magic happens suddenly.
Yeah.
You know, because you experience, it's nice to experience having a car because you wanted to have a car and you thought that you will be adult in the time you have a car, and you realize you are adult no more. You are no more adult when you are having a car than, like, I know, a month ago, you know. But it's nice to have a car and then change perspective on the car. Like, you can use it as a tool for something else. Yeah. Or you can use it, car is, like, bad example in this situation. But you can use it like art object or something and find meaning in these ordinary things, in ordinary relationship things and things around us.
That's well said, and that's exactly it. That re-enchantment of things so that they speak to us of being and not just of having, that's very much what starts to happen to people if they undertake the cultivation of wisdom. So I think coming out of modal confusion is a big thing. That's a form of self-deception. Because your framing is making things salient to you in the wrong way when you're in modal confusion. And so I think coming out of modal confusion is a really important example of the kind of self-deception we have to overcome if we want to awaken from the meaning crisis. But again, we can get locked into ways of framing that are culturally reinforced. That was Fromm's point, that make it very difficult for us to do that, to awaken so we can re-enchant ourselves in the world. But you know, the thing is, when you talk to people, when you study meaning in life, the stuff doesn't matter. Let me be careful. As long as people are in poverty, the stuff matters, as it should. soon as people get out of poverty, you have to do huge increases in wealth to make very small differences in subjective well-being. And then here's the second kicker. Subjective well-being, which is your sense of, I'm sort of contented and happy with my life, is not the same thing as meaning in life. Because when you have a kid, for example, subjective well-being goes way down. You're like, oh, you're not sleeping, you're fatigued, you're hungry, you're wet, right? You and your partner are fighting. Why do people do it? Because they have enhanced meaning in life. So when you ask people at the end what really mattered, if they got out of poverty, they'll tell you it's the relationships they formed, right? The meaningful connections they had to other people, to themselves. They'll often talk about important parts of their lives where they really learned about themselves in a profound way. And they'll also talk about the people they loved, the self-knowledge they got, and also the places that they most felt like they belonged. They'll talk about the love, they'll talk about some place that they loved being in, right? That's what matters to people. They'll talk about, I have a good life. I've loved these people and we've worked on this thing together. That's what they'll talk about. And you'll ask them, well, you've owned like 17 cars. They'll go, yeah, who cares? Most of them. Some people will go, yeah, and I need 17 more.
Right? You've mentioned love a lot of times now, and I really like your description of love. How does reciprocal opening lead to love? How do you describe love? And I think you are describing love not only to a person, but also to reality. Is this right?
Yeah, can very you love much.
Reality?
So one way you can sloganize everything I'm doing about how to awaken from the meaning crisis is, I want to teach people how to fall in love with reality again. Because that's the only real response to nihilism, falling in love with reality again. So the first thing to say right off the bat, and it goes with everything we're talking about, is love is not an emotion. Most especially, it's not a feeling. Feelings and emotions aren't the same thing, right? But love isn't even an emotion, it's an existential mode. If I love someone, that will cause different emotions in me. It might cause anger, sadness, joy, jealousy, right? Okay, so love is an existential mode. Well, what kind of existential mode in it? Well, think about, we use this falling in love because we're wanting to convey that we're caught up in a process that's changing our relationship to something that's encompassing us. Like if I fall, right, my relationship to the ground is changing. They're approaching each other, they're getting closer to each other, and it's something that I'm not sort of dictating, but something that I'm participating in, right? Now, I wish we had a better metaphor than fall, because falling typically has a bad ending. So that's why I have this notion of reciprocal opening. It's the opposite of Mark Lewis's notion of addiction as reciprocal narrowing. So reciprocal opening, well, when you fall in love with somebody, and let's say that it's in the being mode, right? You really want to connect to this person. And I don't mean just physically. You really want to know them with all four knowings, which means you want to participate in their identity. You want to be able to share their states of consciousness, their minds, their emotional states. You want to coordinate your skills with their skills and their habits. And you want to help each other to cultivate virtues. Right. And at the top, you want to, although it doesn't seem to matter as much in relationships, you want to have overlapping beliefs, right? Things like that. Okay. So you want to get to know somebody. Well, this is what the work of Aaron showed. What happens is, say you think, I think I could really get a meaningful relationship. So what you do is you disclose something about yourself. You open yourself up a bit. You reveal some of who and what you are, so that the person can see more deeply into you. Now, they might just say, screw off, but they might pick up on that, and they might go, oh, and they can feel something in them that is called by that, and they respond by opening themselves up a little bit and disclosing themselves about something about themselves so that you can see more deeply into them. And then because you can see more deeply into them, here's where it starts to reverberate. You know, hey, I can open myself up more, but I can open up myself this way because that's how they see. And if I open myself up this way, they'll be able to see more deeply into me. So I'm going to open myself up this way. And then they see more deeply into me, which means they open themselves up more deeply for me. And you see what's going on? It starts to feed back on itself. And I fall in love with them. And I get caught up in, right? I want to, right? I start to, they keep opening up. I keep finding out more. And they're not a problem to be solved. They're a mystery in which I continually grow. And they relate to me as a mystery through which they continually grow. And so we're in love. We're not just having each other or having sex or et cetera. We're in love. It's an existential reciprocal opening. But think about how this could happen. This was Plato's great insight to my mind. This can happen with the world, right? Suppose you know yourself in the Socratic sense. You start to know yourself, and you start to understand your operating system and your owner's manual better, and you reconfigure your psyche so that you're a little less self-deceptive. Now you start to see patterns in the world that you couldn't see before, most likely real patterns. And you start to get better at connecting to the world. The world opens itself up to you. And you say, oh, that's how the world is. And I'm getting better at seeing real patterns. What I'm going to do is I'm going to use that skill of real patterns to find some of the deeper real patterns in me. And I also see how I should open up if I want to see the world better. So I'm going to reconfigure myself to, right, to see better into the world. And I'm going to, right? Oh, I'm starting to get, find the real patterns in me. And I'm starting to see the real patterns in the world. And they're starting to resonate with each other. And I fall in love with, and I continue to fall in love with the world as a mystery in which I have increasing realization of deeper and deeper levels of reality as deeper and deeper levels of my psyche are called forth. I fall in love with reality. And then if you ask me, is my life meaningful? I'm going to say, yeah, it's really meaningful.
This is beautiful. For us, again, from the neuroscience point of view, it's the change of the brain processes that are causing the physical change of the brain, and the brain, how the brain changes, it changes our perception of the world, right?
Right.
So it's changing the salient landscape, because whatever you notice in your mind, whatever you are thinking, that thing is getting stronger and stronger. And brain really likes to notice things it already knows. Therefore, the more you kind of think about these things and open up to the world and maybe, you know, think of possibilities in the world that you have instead of problems, something like that, then in the world, you are literally going to see more possibilities than the problems. And then there is this theory that is building up on that a bit with positive emotions, and that's broad and build theory.
Yeah, Fredrickson's broad and build theory. Mm-hmm. Yeah, positive emotions. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And the thing for me is I see this cycle of reciprocal opening both in the practice, not the theories, but the practice of science and the practices of spirituality. Look, I'm a good scientist. Like, what is the experimental method? It's a method for overcoming self-deception. People, science, right? Science has its flaws, right? But you know what? It's really good at overcoming self-deception. So I start to pick up on the real patterns. I do an experiment so I can distinguish causation from correlation. I get the real patterns. And then as I start to realize some of the real patterns, what do I do if I'm a good scientist? I go back and I start to redesign my theory and my experiments, right? So that I'm even less self-deceived. And then I see more real, and it goes like this. Right? But that's the same thing that I'm doing in spirituality. That's why I think they're ultimately siblings rather than enemies.
Yeah. Like we discuss a lot of topics right now. And for a human being that listens to it for its first time, it may seem like overwhelming. And I would like to ask you about some of your daily routines. What are you practicing, actually? What are you interested in right now? Because it seems almost impossible to be interested in so many topics, being a philosopher, being a cognitive scientist, and doing so much like integrational practices, like you are doing the online like video lessons and these things. What are your daily routines? Like how you integrate all of these things?
So, I mean, I have a morning and an evening routine that sort of bookend my day and act as like the container for my day. And the idea is it permeates forward from my morning and it permeates backward as I'm anticipating going to the evening. Hmm. Right. So what do I do in the morning? I get up and if possible, I try to remember my dreams and I write down my dreams because I went through Jungian therapy. I knew how to do dream work. This is an important way of getting conscious and unconscious mind to talk to each other. Then, of course, I text the woman that I'm profoundly in love with. as we start our day together. My son is living with me. I see how he's doing. You know, check in with him, make sure his needs are going to be met. Then I go for a walk. Now, when I'm doing a walk, obviously I'm doing it for physiological reasons. But while I'm walking, I'm doing a series of practices. So I'm doing a practice from Epicureanism, basically as I'm learning to just savor the pure joy of being. So you get into a practice where you open yourself up and you just let your perceptual machinery, you soak up the world perceptually, but you also, it's called prehension. You let your mind also go out and consider all the possible patterns that you're not directly perceiving, but are nevertheless there. You just soak it up and you just in joy. Joy isn't about pleasure. This joy is that sense of connectedness. I just enjoy the pure joy of being. Okay. And then what I do is then I move from that into a Neoplatonic practice of where I start to realize, like we were talking about, I start to try to afford the reciprocal opening. I try to see how, okay, there's all this patterning going on and it's equally within me and without me. Right. And so I see how, you know, I sense, I don't just see, I sense, both see and mind, I sense how reality has this self-sustaining aspect to it that makes it stable, and I'm participating in that. And then reality has this self-organizing aspect that makes it vital and alive and filled with energy, and I'm participating in that. And then reality has this way in which it's ordered, it's intelligible, it makes sense, and I participate in that. And then I see how, right, these two directions. There's a unity beyond all things, and there's a uniqueness of each thing, and they completely interpenetrate each other, and I do that practice. Then I come back to my place, and I do some Tai Chi Chuan exercises, and some Qigong exercises, some Pranayama exercises. Then I go into a meditative practice, a contemplative practice, and then a Prajna practice that puts them all together. And then I do a Lectio Divina. You learn how to read in the reciprocal opening fashion, and I'll read some poetry, and I'll read some prose. And this is a way of learning in reading in which you're not trying to consume information. You're trying to open yourself up to resonate. You're invoking the text to transform you. And I do the Lectio Divina. And then I go in and I read from a daily Stoic reading, how to practice Stoicism. And then to complement that, I review how to actually do the spiritual exercises. And then I pick one of the cognitive biases that I'm going to look for throughout the day.
That's awesome.
And then I finish by reading one of those texts that is simultaneously, remember I was mentioning it, the intellectual, conceptual, and the mindfulness transformative. I read like a Neoplatonic philosopher. And then I commit myself to trying to live that out through the day. And at the end of the day, when I go to bed, I take out the journal in which I recorded. And what I do is I look for, okay, what vice did I commit today? What vices? What good did I fail to do, did I admit to do that I could have? What bias? Did I notice the bias that I learned about? Did I notice the confirmation bias? Did I notice fundamental attribution error? And then what virtue? What moments did I show of insight, virtue, transformation, aspiration? And then I go to sleep.
Wow. That was amazing. We are, one of our things to do to put out in the world is only the things that we would also like to consume ourselves. We are basically doing this for ourselves. So this is amazing because now I'm like, I wanted to write all these things down. I'm like, oh my God, we are actually recording it. This is this is for me, for the future me. So thank you for this. That was amazing. Something came up to my mind, actually. I was walking and doing a similar thing as I was walking through the forest. I was, was at all in with the nature and I was noticing the unnoticeable, basically. I cannot see all the patterns. Yeah. And then it was, and it transforms into, I cannot intellectually comprehend all these things. And it transforms into feeling, into a state of mind, a state of being. And then I go and I see my house. It's this big block which was made during communism in our country. And I'm like, oh, this is considered like an ugly structure. But I was in this mode and I was like, why would it be ugly? Why do I have to be like, that's ugly? Why do I have to kind of destroy this state of mind? And I was like, at all, with this building. This building is huge. I'm living in it. People made it. And I connected the nature of it with the history of it and with all the connections people made and possibility of us as humans creating these kind of things. And you can do this with everything. And it was such a beautiful moment because I kept the feeling and it was so powerful feeling that like, wow, like what is actually happening? And you can do this, like this fascination with every little thing around you in this room. And I am in this building right now. And that's so crazy. And you can do this with, with the snap of a finger. And then you're like, wow, reality, like what's actually happening? And that's such a beautiful moment. So
for me, that's, here's another Socratic slogan. Wisdom begins in wonder. That's the state of wonder. See, wonder is from the being mode. Curiosity is the having mode, and curiosity is good. What's this? And I want to consume some information. I need the answer. Curiosity. But notice if I extend you to your curiosity forever, that's hell. I'm going to get you to read this detective story, but you'll never get to the end, and you'll never find out who actually committed the murder. You'll just keep that's hell, right? But wonder. Notice what you wanted to do with wonder. Wonder is from the having mode. You just want to open yourself up and keep doing it until you get to a state of awe. That state of wonder is the state, I believe, wisdom begins in wonder because it opens us up to transformation. And notice what you were tasting. You were tasting the reality of falling in love with being, which is you're not offering an ideology. You're not offering a theory. You're not offering some new age pseudoscientific bullshit. No, the universe is actually made up of dead elves or anything like that. You're just falling in love with being again. Yes. But the thing is, so both things are true. It's available to you right here, right now. And in one sense, it's the easiest thing, but it's also, and this is the Zen thing. It's also, you could be so much better at it, right? So much more comprehensively. So when I started studying Zen, mountains were mountains and rivers were rivers. When I was studying Zen, mountains weren't mountains and rivers weren't rivers. And then when I was done studying Zen, mountains were mountains and rivers were rivers. But
that's beautiful. There is this quote which is in this dissertation work of Daniel Christian Wahl, and it's he's writing about this kind of thing. I would like to read it to you right now. Paying attention to the participatory nature of all existence and our associated creative agency in the world can help us to overcome the alienation and lack of meaning which characterizes the modern world.
Totally. Who wrote that?
Daniel Christian Wahl. He is I don't know which university, but it's his dissertation work. I'm gonna link in the description again his work because it's really amazing read actually.
Yeah. So I should get going. I have to do another. I've got to do another installment of Untangling the World Knot with Greg Enriquez on consciousness.
Oh, great! Wow. Yeah, the talks on consciousness were amazing. And it's your just amount of work that you put out is really incredible. And we are like, I feel gratitude, and we are so thankful for your time. It's amazing that you accept it, and it's just it's like a dream we're living right now. It's crazy. Thank you so much for this.
Oh, thank you. In fact, I this went really, really wonderfully for me. It would be great if I could have a copy for this and I could put it up on my channel of the video and the audio.
Yes, definitely.
Yeah, definitely. We'll send it to you.
Great.
Okay.
Well, thank you so much, guys. This was Dialogos. You know, we're reciprocally opening. We're getting to places that we couldn't get to on our own. That was amazing. Thank you so very, very much.
Wow.
And, if you want to have me back at some future date, I'll come back.
That would be amazing. Yeah. It's an honor that you are. Mm-hmm. This is the main point of us doing this, not only ask questions, but actually reciprocal open with you and with the world to actually come up with things we didn't yet know, we didn't know yet. So to get actually some insight in the conversation. So thank you so much for this. It was amazing experience.
And these conversations, they are really the core of our existence. Like I feel like my body, I feel my mind, and they are going together in these conversations. So thank you for this experience. And we are looking forward to the future, to talk to you again and to your future work.
Yep.
Thank you very much, guys.
Okay. And thanks to the listeners and watchers on YouTube as well. All the links are going to be in the description to the link of John, to the YouTube channel of John, to the Discord channel, and all the things we've mentioned. So thank you for this experience. Have an amazing day and amazing consciousness talk, John. It was a pleasure. Pleasure.
Thank you very much, guys. Take good care.
Okay. Bye. See you later.
Bye.
Bye. Take care.